Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of Straight Talk here on The Voice, 830 AM WEEU, online at 830WEEU.com, and now at 1160 AM WBYN. Folks, it's Nick Lawrence. I'm excited about doing our show, as I always am, because we have the best guests, literally are from around the world, to talk to us about topics that affect our daily lives in one form or another. And even if it doesn't perfectly impact your own personal life, maybe there's somebody who will benefit from what you're going to be hearing on our show. Well, our special guest is an attorney. She's an advocate. She's a public speaker. And she's a frequent guest on radio and TV shows talking about criminal justice. Anyway, she has a brand new book out. It's called War on Us: How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on All of Us. Our special guest is Colleen Cowles. Colleen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nick. It's great to be here.
It's exciting to talk to you about a topic that, affects a lot of people these days in America, where, the focus is on the coronavirus these days. But this topic, war on drugs, opiate problems, that's a big deal in our society. Colleen, before we get into all of this, give us a little bit about your story, because I think that's at the basis of this, isn't it?
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, I came to this topic I certainly didn't expect to be writing a book on drug policy at this point in my life, but it was a combination of professional and personal background. Our family, over 15 years ago now, ran head on into the addiction and the drug policy issues. And as an attorney, I really believed that I had a handle on drug policy. I'm not a criminal attorney, although I've ended up studying this topic extensively. But by trade, I'm an estate planning and a tax attorney.
Okay.
Our son had a health problem. It's an autoimmune issue, and often those issues they go undiagnosed for a very long time. And that was the case with him. He actually developed symptoms when he was 7 years old and wasn't officially diagnosed until his late 20s. So he went for a very long time, not for lack of trying, but he went for a very long time without a proper diagnosis and proper treatment, and ultimately began self-medicating to solve the pain issues,
sure,
the very severe chronic pain, and did develop some substance use disorders. But what shocked me when we ended up with personal experience was that the drug policy actually did more harm than the drugs.
Okay.
And that was shocking to me, certainly not something that I expected. And then I started realizing that the people who are most affected by this really have no voice, because mm-hmm. we've deemed them to be criminals.
Yeah, I think until somebody's involved in a particular system, we don't fully understand it. We have ideas about it, maybe based on things that we've heard, but until you're actually in this system, you don't realize what all the different aspects of it that they are. So you found out the hard way, basically, that the system was not working for your son.
Yeah, I definitely did. And I think what shocked me the most was that each person in the system, including myself, believes that they understand the system. And that's where it gets more difficult to change.
Yeah.
But when we saw the entire impact of the system, if you're a criminal justice or a law enforcement person, it's understandable that you're seeing the harms of addiction, and it's understandable that some of the attitudes are out there that we need to stop this use and lock them up. And I get that, because that's the part of it that that person sees.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are even told that we should let them hit bottom, and that we can somehow harm our children, or whether adult or teenagers, by advocating for them. So the typical support system a lot of times isn't there, even though the parents want to be there, families want to be there, But the information out there is, it can really be damaging. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you mentioned that thing about hitting bottom. That was one of the things I was reading about in your book. And so why, I mean, people will say that, you know, if somebody's tried many times, let's say, to stop using or whatever their particular mm-hmm. addiction is, and then eventually, you know, you get, people get frustrated because they're not changing, or they, or there's a recidivism rate, like a relapse rate, okay?
Yeah.
So when people say, just let them hit bottom until it's so bad that they'll make a choice to change, why is that not good advice? Good advice.
Well, there's a myth on the in the very foundation of that, and that is that addiction is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And drug use is a choice, you know, and if we think about that, I mean, obviously, if somebody is putting a pill in their mouth or sticking a needle in their arm, that is a choice. What's not a choice is the impact of that.
Well, you know, see, that right there, I've never heard it said that way, but it's a really profound statement. You said drug use is a choice, but addiction is not.
Yes.
Okay.
And well, when we look at statistics on that, these are supported by study after study after study, if two people can do exactly the same thing, so you try a drug. And that might be anything from alcohol to, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
10 to 20% of people will develop an addiction. 80%, 80 to 90%. The statistics are it depends on how you calculate cannabis use, because there's more people that use cannabis use.
Sure.
There's a 9% addiction rate on cannabis. But between 80 to 90% of people can use drugs and use them for a while on a regular basis and not become addicted.
Okay.
When I read that statistic, I was shocked, because that really kind of throws out the whole idea that we can look at someone and say, well, we should judge you and we should punish you, because if 80-90% of the people did the same thing but had a different result, then maybe that philosophy is flawed.
Yeah.
So when I look at the whole hitting bottom thing, I think when we look at what we do to someone who has an addiction problem, if we use those same tactics on any other health issue, we would have an epidemic with that too.
Absolutely. That's a really good analogy saying that, really. So I think it's interesting. Okay, so if 80 or 90% of the people who try drugs and use drugs, even, you know, depending which ones they were, obviously, on mm-hmm. a regular basis, some of them are much more highly addictive than others, and they can choose to use them in a moderate way, what causes the other 10 or 20% to become addicted?
Well, there's a lot of theories on that. But what we now know is that the vast majority is based on trauma and isolation.
Okay, wow.
So a lot of it is so when we look at how we handle this, what do? We increase trauma and we increase isolation. So it's not really surprising that the war on drugs has escalated the addiction and overdose epidemic, because everything that we're doing to try to minimize it is exactly what escalates it.
It's interesting, because there's an analogy. I don't know if it's a perfect analogy or not, but I know that when kids are raised in orphanages, let's say in foreign countries, and we adopt them here, mm-hmm. if you use a typical discipline method on, like, reward deprivation, it doesn't work, because they were deprived from the very beginning. So it makes the problem even worse when we try to apply what we would call a normal or rational approach to discipline. So that's exactly what you're saying here. We traumatize people and isolate them if they're drug users, which actually exacerbates the problem, from what you're telling me.
Exactly. And that even goes so far as how we handle teenagers who might be experimenting once. We've now instituted drug testing policies in our high schools, where if a student is tested, and legally you can only be tested if you're in extracurricular activities, and you can be thrown out of those extracurricular activities.
Sure.
If you test positive. But that's doing two things. One is, if a child or a teenager has experimented and gets caught, now we ban them from all of the positive things that he's doing or she's doing. And the other thing that's happening with that statistically is cannabis, which is less dangerous, stays in the blood for up to a month, mm-hmm. whereas a lot of the more serious drugs only stay in the system for hours or days. Mm-hmm. So we've seen a conversion of teenagers going to harder drugs in order to beat the drug tests, because cannabis is more likely to be picked up. So a lot of our policies, if we really look at what so many times what's instinctive and emotional, when we really look at the cascade effect of that, it produces the exact opposite result mm-hmm. of what we want.
So I would think also that the more we try to stop people from using drugs and trying to catch them, the more crafty they become about hiding it, and therefore it really drives them deeper into these places where we can't find them, and then the problem would seem to me it gets even much more worse.
Well, and it makes it very, very difficult for someone to come forward and ask for help.
Yeah.
Because if they step forward and ask for help, they might find themselves behind bars or at a minimum stigmatized. And,
yeah.
and so we really make it very, very difficult. I mean, if you compare this, I think one of the things that really tipped the scales for me, too, when I started researching this is use of medications. And those, according to our own government, are it's the most effective treatment model. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't need to figure out, you know, why somebody had the susceptibility to addiction anyway.
Right.
But if we can, according to the SAMHSA, the government organization that deals with drug abuse, medications can cut the overdose rates by half. And
wow.
We have a lot of people who have been in and out of peer support groups, 12 steps, which, by the way, can be very helpful, but it's more a support group than medical treatment. We've had people who failed in those programs repeatedly, and through medications, they're getting their lives back.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, at the same time, our jails, our prisons, our sober houses, a lot of our treatment centers, a lot of the peer support meetings, the probation, the drug courts, most of them prohibit medications.
Really?
We arrest someone for a substance use issue, and then we prohibit the most effective treatment for the issue that we arrested them for.
Wow. Folks, we're talking to Colleen Cowles. She's an attorney, and she's the author of War on Us, How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on All of Us. I have lots of more questions for her. You can go to her website, which is the title of the book, waronus.com. Check it out. There's plenty of things. This book is an amazing book, folks. Whether it's something you've had to deal with, that you might have to deal with, or you know somebody who's dealing with the idea of being caught in the criminal justice systems regarding drug use, this is an amazing book. You need to read it. We all need to read it, whether you actually have been affected by this or not, because the information is just very powerful. Anyway, we're going to take a short break. We will be back with our guest in just a moment. You know what you're doing now? You're listening to Straight Talk. I call it that for a reason, right? Because this is the kind of stuff we talk about here. We talk about everything that's important on this show, and I need you to tell everybody about our show so that they'll come and listen as they're doing right now, either listening right now on the radio with me, or if you choose to, you can be listening to it online at 830weeu.com. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Nick Lawrence. Stay with me.
And I'll be there, yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got a friend.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Now, isn't that a good message, especially with the topic we're talking about? And instead of judging people that are having issues with drugs, maybe we need to show a little compassion, a little friendship to help them through those things, because as our guest has said, maybe using drugs is a choice, but getting addicted to them is not necessarily that. We're going to understand a lot more of that as we talk to our guests. You're listening to Straight Talk here on The Voice, 830 AM WEEU, online at 830WEEU.com, and now at 1160 WBYN. Now, I mentioned our website. That's important because just in case you're just tuning into the show right now and you say, geez, I missed that first part, how can I hear this again? You can always go to our website. All you need to do is scroll down the homepage, 830WEEU.com, and you scroll down the homepage, you get to the section called Straight Talk in our podcast section. It's an MP3 format. You can listen to this as often as you would like to do that, and you're going to want to do that. And then you're going to want to tell people about this particular interview. But in general, I want you to tell everybody about our show, because we talk about things that are important here. Everybody needs to have a good source of information. And the guests that I have on my show are experts in their field. So we're talking with Colleen Cowles. She's the author of War on Us: How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on All of Us. Colleen, I'm back with you, and I was intrigued by the idea that you did a comparison between prohibition and today. Why do you think that the war on drugs is reminiscent of prohibition?
Well, unfortunately, we didn't learn as much as we should have from alcohol prohibition. One of the stories in the book is a favorite family story. Growing up, my mother grew up in the Depression, and in order to afford to finish high school, she actually lived at the county jail with her uncle for
really?
A few months in order to finish high school.
Wow.
But she tells some of my favorite stories as a child were her stories about Uncle John notifying the farmers when the federal agents were coming in so that they could hide their stills. And when I started looking at the war on drugs and looking at many of the law enforcement agencies now saying, we are not going to arrest for this. It's a revolving door. It's not working, and it's harming people, and it's also harming the police, making their jobs much more difficult in many ways. But we've come full circle where we have policy that is so incredibly bad that the frontline law enforcement are beginning to say there is less harm if we don't enforce this law.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've kind of got de facto legalization in those jurisdictions where, someone is fortunate enough to have law enforcement entering into agreements with treatment facilities and coordinating help rather than giving people criminal records that can impact their opportunities for life.
So why doesn't punishment work, though, Colleen? It seems to be, we think in terms of discipline, I'll teach you a lesson, and then you'll be better when you get out from this. But why doesn't that punishment system work?
Well, I think a lot of it is that we are assuming that if you can only punish something and change something if it is a choice. So we go back to that. If you're addicted,
mm-hmm.
For me, I drink Diet Coke. I know it's not good for me. But if someone came in and said, if you ever try that for the rest of your life, we are going to lock you up and you are going to come out with a criminal record. And you are going to have trouble finding housing. You will have trouble finding work. If my life is destroyed with something like Diet Coke, maybe I could change. But anyone who's been on any kind of a diet realizes that if you're asked to change something for the rest of your life, that's a pretty tough ask.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now you add with drug addiction there were probably the vast majority of people with addiction issues also have accompanying physical or mental health issues, which aren't treated and are a lot of times exacerbated when they are arrested and whether they're incarcerated or punished. So we're not treating that. And there's the component of withdrawal and, the whole health component where they're literally sick, which is where these medications come in, because mm-hmm. that is something that will minimize or eliminate the withdrawal symptoms and will take care of the physical attributes of an addiction.
So, Colleen, you according to what I was reading in the book, I read your book, most of it anyway, that you have two sons. And both of them were in the system in some form or another. Both of them had totally different outcomes. What made the difference in those outcomes?
The primary difference was the way that the criminal justice system handled them.
Can you explain
to
us?
Yeah, with one son, we were able to deal with the authorities, and we said we are going to get him help, which we did. They worked with us to allow him to get help. His record was expunged. And at this point, that history when he was a young adult is completely erased, and it hasn't impacted his life.
Mm-hmm.
The other son, over a very minor initial drug arrest, was put in jail. Some other medications, because he has some health problems, were taken from him. So he was in excruciating pain behind bars, and ended up with a felony conviction, which has impacted him and will impact him for the rest of his life. So when we look just generally, there's really mixed messages in this country. I mean, our movies glamorize drug use in a lot of ways. We've got three presidents who have admitted to drug use,
right?
And yet, you know, if they had been arrested and ended up with felonies or even a minor drug conviction, they probably would not have been president.
Mm-hmm. So
it's not the difference. It's the difference in criminal justice system rather than the difference in drug use.
Well, then I was just going to ask you that kind of anyway. So the system itself doesn't show any true compassion. So are you just fortunate if you run into people in the system who haven't bought the system completely and are willing to subvert it to help people like one of your sons?
Absolutely. And it's really a matter of luck, because in one jurisdiction, having a police officer find you with in possession of a controlled substance may get you free treatment. Mm. In the next jurisdiction, it may get you 7 years in jail and a felony record for the rest of your life. So we're completely inconsistent in our treatment of this.
Mm-hmm.
Another point that people, I think it's really important to understand for a listening audience, is that even if you don't know anyone who has addiction issues, you've never tried an illegal drug, don't intend to, you're still at risk, because we have gone so far past science and medicine, and we're in such hysteria about the overdose epidemic, and it's, you know, legitimately it's of great concern. We're losing approximately 70,000 people a year to drug overdose, but in an attempt to solve that issue, we now have the DEA raiding physicians' offices and calling physicians, threatening them if they're prescribing medications. And a lot of these situations are pain patients who've successfully been on these medications for a very long time. And out of fear, now physicians are either leaving the practice or some of them are completely cutting people off of those medications. Others are significantly reducing the amount of medications. So everyone that's listening is potentially one surgery or one car accident away from not getting medical treatment that is proven effective.
So, Colleen, why are we such pendulum swingers, right? I mean, okay, so the mm-hmm. abuse of opioids by the medical profession became evident, and a lot of people are getting addicted. Well, now the answer is not to go the extreme the other end, and yet that's what we're doing, or the government's trying to enforce that in some way. Why can't we come back to the middle and use medications the way they've been prescribed and on a reasonable basis? People do need medications. You can't just all of a sudden cut them off when they're intractable, mm-hmm. when they're in intractable pain or they need those things.
Well, and that's another example of where the emotional reaction to something is bringing about the exact opposite reaction. Because
right.
now we've got pain patients who, well, suicide rates have escalated significantly, but we've also got pain patients that are so desperate that they're going to the street and overdosing on tainted drugs, because the street drugs, you can't tell the quantity, and there's fentanyl and you know, nasty things in,
sure.
In those drugs. But in answer to your question, Nick, part of the problem is that we don't look at the statistics, we react.
Okay.
I was shocked after all of what I'd heard about the opioid epidemic. When you look at the statistics, the overdose rate on patients taking opioids that are prescribed by their physicians is less than 1%. So that is not the problem.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't realize it was that low.
Yeah, it's incredibly low. Even the overall addiction rate
yeah.
is between 7%, and at the absolute cap is 6%, according to one study. So we're compromising the health care of everyone in the country because of inaccurate data. Mm-hmm. And again, hysteria, I mean, it's really not based on the statistics.
Mm-hmm. See, and that's what I love about your book, that all the research you did, you have a basis for pretty much everything that you're saying. So as you're thinking, as you're talking, I was just wondering, do you believe in the concept of gateway drugs? In other words, is something, you know, the argument has been that things like cannabis, you know, is a gateway drug. Other people say, well, no, it's not that. I mean, mm-hmm. do you have an answer for us, at least your perspective on it?
Well, I think if it is a and I can talk about the studies, but if it is a gateway drug, it is a gateway drug because particularly with young people, if they want cannabis, and if a young person, if anybody wants to use a drug, there's supply in this country.
They're going
it's
to find it.
It's not a matter of, yeah, they're going to find it. The question is whether we want to put them in touch with the street dealer who also offers all of these other substances, or whether we want to put them in a regulated market that checks IDs. And it's interesting, the statistics on the states that have legalized cannabis, use has actually decreased in the younger people.
Yeah.
Because there aren't as many street dealers, and when you go into the legal cannabis dealers, they do check IDs. So it's actually been beneficial as far as cutting the rate of use. Same thing happened in Portugal. In 2001, they had a similar situation to ours. Rampant drug use, 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, huge HIV issues, and they decided they needed to do something different. So they decriminalized all drugs as of 2001.
Okay.
And at this point, the overall drug use has remained about the same, but the drug use in the under 25 has dropped significantly. The overdose rates have dropped significantly.
Wow.
And it's an incredible success story. But what they did is took all of the money that we spent over $1 trillion on incarcerating people and prosecuting them. Portugal took those funds and they converted it from this punitive system and put those funds to public health.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone has a drug issue, they can get treatment immediately. There are programs to help them in finding work. And the statistics are just absolutely amazing.
Right.
And over that time period since 2001, there has been a lot of political political changes within Portugal, and every party there has maintained these programs because they work so well.
Well, that's good. Before we take our next break, Colleen, tell everybody what they will find. I have about a minute or so. Tell us what they'll find if they go to your website, waronus.com.
There are free samples of the book. There's also a free report, 9 Ways to Minimize the Risk of Overdose. Which whether you know somebody in your family or not, having that information, you could literally save a life.
Mm-hmm.
And there's videos and a lot more information on the topic.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff on that website, which I have up in front of me. Folks, you're listening to Straight Talk Mail. It's ironic the name of the show is about straight talk. We're talking about drugs tonight. So it's an important topic, really. But you can go to our website to listen to the show again at 830weeu.com. Just scroll down the homepage until you get to the section called Straight Talk, but I am going to encourage you to go to her website, which is the name of the book, waronus.com. Stay tuned, folks. We'll come back after these messages. We have a lot more to talk about with our guest, Colleen Cowles, an amazing topic that we need to discuss for our benefit and society's benefit. We'll be back after these messages, so stay with me. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Straight Talk. Welcome if you're just joining us here on The Voice, 830 AM WEEU, online at 830WEEU.com and out at 1160 AM WBYN. Our special guest, Colleen Cowles. She's the author of War on Us, How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on all of us. Our website is the name of the book, waronus.com. Colleen, before we get into something else, I want to ask you, what about that song? You know, people, they don't want you to get involved in their lives. Just leave me alone. I'm okay. You know, I'm going to live my own life. It's my life. How do you get through to someone who resists being helped when they already know, when they know down deep inside that they have a problem?
Well, I think giving some legitimate help rather than judgment, compassion over judgment, goes a long way. Because legitimately, if I had an issue and I saw what happens if I come forward or if I'm caught and picked up, it's such a disaster that I wouldn't step forward either. You know, if I was risking having my health care taken away, being put behind bars, being stigmatized for the rest of my life, I probably wouldn't ask for help either.
So that's what you're saying, that the system is so terrible because it discourages people who genuinely want to change from actually seeking help, because they might be incarcerated rather than getting help, is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
And that would ruin their whole life, as you just mentioned, right? So it's, I don't know, it's kind of a catch-22 for parents too, isn't it, though? That, in other words, you want to get your child to get help, but if you get help through the criminal justice system, they could go to jail. But if you don't get them help, they could stay addicted. So it's kind of a catch-22 in a way. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, I think a lot of it and that's really the, you know, where I started doing research, because the answers that were out there just didn't make sense to me. They were very conflicting. They didn't seem to have good statistical success rates. So that's, you know, initially why I started digging. There are solutions, but they're medical solutions. So, and to expect someone who is in active addiction to research treatment options and to try to find ways of being able to get into the right program, try to find funding to pay for it, that's an impossible task. And if we ask someone who is suffering from cancer, if we told the families, well, you know, they shouldn't have smoked or they shouldn't have eaten, you know, anything other than vegetables.
Sure.
And so therefore we should punish them. And by the way, it's, you know, they're responsible for solving the problem themselves. So don't help them get treatment. And we're going to mandate peer support groups, which can be great, but we're going to mandate those and not allow medical treatment. But then if that mandated peer support group doesn't solve the problem, we're going to put you in jail.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, if we, you know, really, if we treated any health issue that way, we'd have a problem.
So you've kind of alluded to some of this, but what would you say some of the other myths are about drug abuse or about addictions? What do we assume is correct, but is not really correct?
Well, I think one of them is that addiction is a moral failing, and we've talked a little bit about that as far as the medications working, and not everybody who does the same thing has the same outcome. Another one that's a problem is the abstinence only. We've kind of taken this perfection model, and statistically, when someone is even going down the right path toward recovery, there is a very, very good chance that they are going to relapse at least once.
Okay.
But we have this perfectionistic model where if they relapse, they're going to probably end up not only in jail, but probably in prison now, because now maybe they've got, you know, a couple of different instances, or if they were on probation and they're picked up. So we've got this perfection model. And the abstinence-only idea also adds a lot of stigma to people who want to use medical treatments, sometimes including medications. There's just not a one-size-fits-all treatment. But so often the treatment for addiction is based on a peer who had success with some, you know, with maybe a 12-step program or a different program that worked beautifully for them, and it might be a great program. But when someone goes through cancer and one particular type of chemo works for them, that doesn't qualify them to tell everybody else that the only way to recover from cancer is that type of chemo. Mm-hmm. And that's the pattern that we've got.
Well, it really makes a whole lot of sense. Now, before we talk about some of the solutions that you propose, why do you say that this impacts all of us? You know, you say it's a war on all of us, and yet most people would think it's just thinking like you about the war on drugs, they're thinking it's just about the addicted individual. Mm-hmm. Why is it a war on all of us?
Well, part of one of the risks is what we had talked about before, as far as the impact on the overall healthcare system. The DEA now is dictating how many medications can be manufactured, and you know, with the COVID-19 going on, we've heard a lot about potential issues with supply chain on prescription medications from mm-hmm. China.
Yep.
Well, we were creating those on our own because the DEA is cutting back on the allowable manufacture of medications to the extent that we're going to have about 53% reduced production of opioids since 2016.
Okay.
Now, those opioids are used legitimately for a lot of people. The other thing is, if we don't treat addiction, there are 70 other health conditions that are created by not treating addiction. So that's flooding the system and compromising everyone's health care. And we're escalating diseases like Hep B and C and HIV. It's increasing the homeless rate, which is creating a whole mm-hmm. lot of problems, including health problems for anybody living in those areas.
So it's kind of like we only see the head of the Hydra, but we don't see the other tentacles, we'll say, right? How it all affects society in many, many ways. We go after the head thinking that that's going to solve the problem, but really all these other branches or these other tentacles are being affected by the drug abuse.
Absolutely. And we've got, almost all of the issues in society have been somewhat escalated by the war on drugs. Mm-hmm. And with cartel earnings from drug sales ranging from $19 to $29 billion annually, a lot of that's going to fund terrorism.
Yeah,
we've got a 15,000% increase in SWAT raids since the late 1970s. So the chances of somebody breaking in your door because somebody called and they've got the wrong address it's a true issue that everybody is at risk for. And now we've got our police spending their time making 1.6 million drug arrests every year. But 38% of murders, I think it's 62% of rapes, and 87% of burglaries go unsolved. So our police are focusing on things that are don't have victims to the extent that obviously murder, rape, and burglary does.
Sure, yeah.
So it does impact all of us.
Yeah. So all right. So we pointed all these things out. What can we do to fix it? What are the solutions in a sense of what we can do to fix this? How do you see how we could make this system better?
Well, ultimately, treating addiction like we treat any other health issue it's proven to work. Again, with Portugal and there's other jurisdictions, and the book does an analysis of what's worked elsewhere. Because if we can look at what has actually worked and pattern solutions after that, and then it's taking the guesswork out of it. But essentially, when there's a lot of talk about ending the war on drugs and public policy changes it from punitive to public health. And I totally agree with all of that, but the bottom line, and nobody really wants to admit this, but the bottom line is the way to do that is to legalize drugs. And that sounds radical, but when you look at what we're doing right now, with 1 in 3 adults in the United States having a criminal record,
mm-hmm.
and people sitting in jail and the escalation, obviously we're not solving the problem with our proposed solutions, and the radical proposal would be to keep doing what we're doing because it hasn't worked in mm-hmm. 50 years. So if we legalize drugs, then we can regulate, we get rid of the cartels or provided that we don't overtax and create a black market, but we can minimize the effect of the drug cartels. We can regulate it's similar to what we've done with the legalization of cannabis in several states.
Mm-hmm.
We can regulate the use, and that is a more feasible approach, and then take a lot of those dollars that are being spent on the punitive approach and applying that to public health.
So the different addiction, the potentiality of different addictions, because certain drugs are more addictive than others, that is not a concern of yours. You're saying we should legalize the drugs and manage them a whole lot better, regardless of what drug that it is. I just have a minute for this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yes, because right now those that are legal versus not legal are totally arbitrary anyway.
Okay.
I mean, you know, morphine is legal. Cannabis is not legal. Cannabis is Schedule One. So our whole drug policy has not been based on fact anyway. And as long as you're regulating them, it's not going to be a whole lot different than what we're doing currently with many drugs.
Well, Colleen, give us a final thought. This has been incredible. Give me a final thought of what you want people to get from your book.
Well, I would hope that anyone listening can think about things just a little bit differently when you're looking at a policy or a politician. This really isn't a partisan issue, but ask yourself, will the position of the politician further stigmatize or punish those that have a substance use disorder, or will it put addiction under the umbrella of public health or of criminal law?
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes when we look at adding more dollars, it's just putting more people behind bars. So if we ask ourselves that, and if you have an opportunity to give somebody an opportunity who has a criminal record, look past just that criminal record, because that might have been a pill in their pocket 20 years ago or 2 years ago. And they may be a phenomenal human being that could really contribute to your business or your community.
Well, Colleen, this has been an incredible interview. I really certainly appreciate you taking the time to share all this information with us. Please stay on the line. I'll be right back with you, okay?
Thanks, sir.
Folks, Colleen Cowles, right? The name of the book is called War on Us, How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on All of Us. Go to our website, name of the book, waronus.com. Certainly think about the things we've talked about on our show. Tell everybody about this particular show and, of course, all the ones we do here on Straight Talk. Think about it, folks. Take care of yourselves. As always, I'll see you on the radio.
If it feels nice, don't